Hello, everyone. I'm Abby Kinney, and you are listening to UpZone. Got my bus pass, been a ride, first class streetcar downtown with a fine ladies in the peeps. OG said, don't hurt nobody. Look at this damn thing, got my fit on. Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of UpZone, a city-focused current events show that takes one story from the news each week, and we talk about it in depth. My name is Abby Kinney, and I am a planning consultant out of Gold Evans, Kansas City Planning Studio. I am joined today by our regular guest, Chuck Marone. How are you doing today, Chuck?
Pretty fantastic. I was in Colorado this week, and a little town called Salida, which is a gorgeous little city of about 5,000 to 6,000. If you get off the highway, it'll knock you out. It's just spectacular. So yeah, I just got back late last night and feeling real good.
That sounds really nice. Did you get any skiing done or snowboarding?
No, I did manage to get a few hours of sleep in between presentations and meetings. But no, besides driving by some people who were on the slopes, that's the closest I got to recreation of any type. Yeah.
Fair enough. So the article that we're covering today, I'm pretty excited about because it takes place in my home state, Missouri, and my current city of Kansas City. The article was published in the opinion section of The Hill by Patrick Tui, which I hope I am pronouncing that correctly. I have a feeling that I'm not.
I don't know. I think that's right.
Tui?
Oh, yeah. That's how I'd say it. Yeah.
All right. Well, it is entitled, "There is No Such Thing as a Free Bus." So as some of you listeners may or may not already be aware, Kansas City has made headlines recently after city officials called for a policy that would help fund fixed route transit for the next fiscal year. This is so that citizens would basically no longer have to pay to use public transportation within the city. This story has been covered all over the media with mostly positive feedback, but this particular story is actually quite critical of the initiative taken on by the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority. In the article, Patrick raises concerns around the possible unanticipated costs of providing free public transit, such as increased maintenance and labor needs caused by, and this is a quote, overcrowded buses, disruptive passengers, and unhappy bus operators, end quote. So this is pulling from examples of fare-free transit programs in cities like Denver and Austin that were ultimately discontinued. The program is estimated to cost around $8 million for citywide coverage, and the proposed Kansas City budget recently put out by Mayor Quinn Lucas is about $3 million short of the ATA's request. The city currently writes a check each year to the ATA for $58 million, I think it is. So this would raise that amount to $63 million. Being here locally, I've talked to lots of people who are both very supportive and very skeptical of this initiative. The author is certainly raising valid questions, but has perhaps unintentionally left out, I think, pieces of information that are important to the discussion. But before we jump into this, I'd like to get your take on the idea of fare-free transit, Chuck. You talk a lot about cities needing to be very thoughtful about what they spend their money on, and this initiative is obviously needing to compete with tons of other programs that the city funds. Do you see fare-free transit as a valuable way of building strong towns?
I would like to answer that yes, but I am more than a little skeptical. And I'm more than a little skeptical only because of the way we historically have treated transit. We have tended to treat transit as transportation for the poor, or alternate transportation, we even call it sometimes. You know, transportation for people who are not in automobiles. The interesting dialogue in that framing has kind of evolved to be now, well, we really subsidize automobiles a lot, and we really subsidize automobile trips like a gargantuan amount. And in fact, I was looking at some data from Kansas City today. When you look at the amount you guys subsidize for parking, it's bizarre. It's insane. And so the idea has been fair is fair. You subsidize driving, we should subsidize transit too. And my reaction to that mindset has always been, how dumb. You know, like, we're going broke one way, let's try to go broke in multiple ways. Obviously, my belief on transit is that transit works best when it connects two places people want to be, when it connects one productive place to another productive place. And when we set the systems up like that, they work really, really well. And so I agree with the sentiment of this article off the top that there's no such thing as free transit. Like, there literally isn't. Someone will pay for it. And when the community is paying for it, the question that I would have is, how do we get that return? Where is the return that pays for this? And just like when we talk about automobile transportation, and I ask the same question, where's the return? To me, the return here needs to show up somewhere in the balance sheet. Are we improving the property values in places that we're connecting? Are we creating, you know, greater employment in the city of Kansas City? You guys have an income tax, and so there's some opportunities for that. Are we increasing our sales tax revenue? And is this a strategy to do that? Those things are all things we can measure. I think if we're talking in that way, I'm all in. Like, let's talk free transit, because I think free transit is a valid, you know, there's a valid argument to be made that the transaction cost of providing a fair collection, in a sense, for this system is greater than what you're actually going to get by doing it. You know, you'd be better off making it free and getting your return somewhere else. But if this is a idea like, well, we just want to be fair to everybody, I think that is a real destructive mindset that is ultimately, I think, going to undermine transit. So I'm interested in your take and you know, where you fall kind of along that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's important to understand that at one point, Kansas City was the type of city that was able to support a very extensive transit system that actually wasn't public. We had private streetcars. I'm personally not losing sleep over the idea of Kansas City raising their bill $5 million to support mobility and access for people. But what concerns me even more is that we haven't been very good stewards of the city we inherited 70 years ago, and that we will continue to miss opportunities to focus reinvestment in a way that actually builds the type of city that supports transit. Today, Kansas City is a municipality of roughly 320 square miles, and we have about 500,000 people. Back in 1950, we were a city of roughly 80 square miles with the same number of people. So we've grown four times, and that means that our transit system is largely spread out as well. Back in the day, we could afford to support 100 miles of private streetcar routes, and the widespread availability of automobiles obviously made the streetcar system obsolete in the first place, but it also changed the way we fundamentally develop cities and produced some serious equity gaps in terms of how we move around and access opportunities, which has left a lot of people out. Not having a car in Kansas City can be very, very challenging. Kansas City has started to pursue transit-oriented development in its downtown with the streetcar line, and that's been largely successful, in my opinion. However, beyond our central core, a lot of our city has not developed in a way that is ideal for supporting transit access. And not only that, but many of our central urban neighborhoods that have been disinvested in, they currently have a rural population density, despite the fact that they have the same physical urban design makeup as our affluent urban core neighborhoods. So there's a lot of challenges, I think, in Kansas City in terms of how we connect productive places and who we're connecting. There's a lot of places that are actually have a very low population density, but a very high need for ridership.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've looked at the maps of Kansas City, and I've seen the statistics that you cite. The population density, if we just look at that as like an outcome metric, is bizarre. I mean, you have in places, you know, a person a square mile in some places. It's a huge, huge area with a very comparatively small population. And the growth you've had post-World War II in area has been, I want to say it's like seven or eight times. and you've actually stagnated your population. So you just have the same number of people supporting vastly more infrastructure. Here's the question I have for you as a local. Is the conversation around this a development strategy conversation? In other words, we have these old streetcar lines and they're really productive neighborhoods, but they've been gutted out and hollowed out. And there's a ton of parking lots and a ton of underutilized space. This is a strategy for making better use of that and getting people to move in these places and getting these neighborhoods really functioning again as neighborhood centers. Or is this a conversation about equity? We subsidize the automobile, or, you know, we have the automobile and we need, you know, to spread out that subsidy a little bit more. What are people leaning into there in terms of the conversation?
I think it depends what circles you're in and who you're talking to. I think it's largely been an equity discussion because there's obvious benefits to having fare-free transit. And in addition to that, fare-free transit would mean that there's that sort of, it removes that barrier of confusion for people who may take the bus that just don't, because they maybe don't know how or are not confident to use the fare box, quite frankly. So I think that this would actually expand options for everybody. But the development side of this and thinking about how to really leverage transit and land use together and thinking of it more cohesively is certainly a discussion that is being had. And maybe it's just because I'm working in the planning world that it's something that comes up quite often. And I think that the precedent that we have is our downtown streetcar line. It's a great example of transit-oriented development and a fare-free transit system. The streetcar is free, I guess I should say, quote-unquote free, because it is funded in other ways that are directly related to development adjacent to the route. Between 2014 and 2019, the Transportation Development District sales tax grew 55% along the streetcar route, which is three times greater than the sales tax growth of the city overall. And I think that the obvious reason for the success of that particular transit-oriented development project is because it's located in the downtown area, which is our most tax-productive area of the city. We do have quite a few streetcar suburbs outside of our urban core that I think could become more productive if the city allowed it to.
I realize that there is a strong equity argument to be made here. I think I would take it a step further and say that if we don't build a system that in a sense creates these positive financial feedback loops, in other words, if we're making investments in transit that don't pay off on the ground in terms of tax base, what will happen is that the transit will become the thing we fund when we funded other things. In good times, we might be able to throw some money at it. In bad times, when we really need it, it will be the thing that gets cut. I think if we want to advocate for transit, which I do, and I as a strong towns approach, I mean, great cities have great transit. I think we have to connect that land use aspect to it as a central part of the conversation. It's the whole way you make the system viable over the long term. And I feel like the critique here from The Hill, from this article from Tui, what's his name? Patrick Tui. He obviously does not seem to be a transit advocate, you know, and this is not a primary thing for him. And I think he's using some very traditional kind of conservative arguments for better or for worse, but you know, saying, well, it's, you know, people are just going to ride all night because they're homeless and the buses are going to be overrun with people, which, you know, awesome. I mean, that'd be great if you had, you know, usage demand that high. But I think he ultimately gets at what I think is really the point, which is there's no such thing as free transit. Public transit is not free. Your Gmail account is not free. It might be free to you to use, but that's only because Gmail is exploiting you. You know, Google's exploiting you to sell ads to other people. You know, you're the, in a sense, the product. When you look at a free bus, someone's paying for that. And if what we're going to say is that the general taxpayer is just going to pay for it because it's the right thing to do, That may be a good argument, and we may like morally feel like that is what a good community should do. And I'm not going to argue with people who would say that. But I think if we want it to be really viable over the long term, we have to also add another central component, which is when we have a bus system operating in this way, or when we have a transit system that's going to work in this way, it's going to allow us to take all those empty parking lots and fill them in with homes, create this missing middle housing, build a bunch of neighborhood nodes that we can connect, that we can start to see, you know, being utilized and see our tax base go up and our jobs go up and the opportunities we create go up. If we don't connect it to a land use strategy, then it's not viable long term.
Yeah. And well, I think this is pretty timely, but the update of the Kansas City ATA's routes, they're actually updating their route planning right now. And they've brought up the idea of a ridership versus coverage approach to providing transit, with the thought that it makes a lot of sense to not focus so much on coverage, but focusing more on ridership and actually increasing services where there are more riders, which is directly related to both need and the equity discussion, but also land use. Where there's more population density, it obviously makes more sense to have frequent bus service. I think that that means that the city seriously does need to take a look at their land use regulations and ensure that we're able to build the type of city that we're really trying to build, which is one that supports transit.
Well, I've learned more about this from Jarrett Walker, a human transit guy, than anything else, this trade-off between ridership and coverage area. And I think in the mindset of the automobile era, it was all about coverage area. How do we provide service to the broadest possible area? And when you look at Kansas City, that means providing really low quality, infrequent, and unreliable service to far-flung areas where few people are. And I think a logical switch in transit is to start to lean a little bit more into ridership. Where can we provide more frequent, more reliable service to places where we have a lot of people looking to ride? And oh, by the way, from a strong towns lens, those also often happen to be the places where we can add a whole broad cross-section of housing to increase the tax base and increase the livability of those neighborhoods. I look back at planning in really the automobile era, the interstate era, and then, you know, coming into the 70s and 80s when we started to plan a lot of these systems, it was really a transportation-focused plan with all the land use kind of being a local concern. You know, that's something someone else will deal with. Well, I think we're at the point of sophistication now, and we're at the point where the problems and the challenges we face are more than just one-dimensional transportation problems, where we have to, if we're going to be responsible, start adding in these other layers. And in fact, I think leading with these other layers, the land use layer, the financial productivity layer, those have to be the central organizing things of any good transit system.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm very encouraged about is the fact that Joe Minicozzi's group, Urban 3, actually completed a study here in Kansas City that helps frame that discussion. And we have the type of community that has the level of sophistication to have these discussions. And these discussions have been occurring in the past year or so. So it is very encouraging. I think that it falls right in line with the idea of fare-free transit and how we build our city in a way that supports that. So I am encouraged. I'm excited. I think that a lot of people will actually end up using the fare-free transit who had not ridden the bus before. So personally, I feel pretty encouraged about this whole effort.
You know, it's kind of fun is to watch a good Midwestern city like Kansas City actually lead on something like this. I'm from Minnesota. I like a lot. Minneapolis has been a leader on a lot of things. I think where we're situated right now, you're between your city and the things going on in my state, there's a lot of great thought and great ideas coming out of them. And it's kind of fun to sit back and highlight one of them today.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. So I think it's time to transition on into the down zone. So this is the part of the show where we get to share what we have been listening to, watching, reading, or just any other unique things that are happening in your life. Chuck, what would you like to share as this week's contribution?
I just finished a book called The Chaos Imperative. The subtitle is How Chance and Disruption Increase Innovation, Effectiveness, and Success. And the author is Ori Braffman and Judah Pollack. I was speaking out in Michigan, and this one guy came up to me afterwards, and he was a former, I want to say, Army Ranger. We talked a little bit about Army life. he was really cool. He was an officer. And he said, your talk reminded me of this book, The Chaos Imperative. And I looked at it and I'm like, that seems maybe, but like a little bit off from what we're talking about. Let me read this. A lot of it was, how do we take these very structured systems? And the author talks about the US military and create space for chaos and disruption. If you think of the military is about the most top-down, hierarchical, structured kind of organization you can. In fact, when I was talking to this guy, my rank when I got out was a sergeant. This guy was like a captain or something like that. The idea of a sergeant and a captain like chumming around after a talk made me feel a little awkward, even though it's been almost 20 years now since I've been out of the Army. It's funny because this book went through and addressed that and said, hey, even in the US military, but also in, you know, just regular civilian organizations, if we don't create room for this kind of unstructured space and disruption, we're really missing something and missing something big. And this book, it was a very quick read, a very short read, but I got a lot out of it. And I'd highly recommend it to people.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a great book. So my contribution to the Down Zone this week is actually something that it has been recently completed on behalf of the Gold Evans Planning Studio. So the Planning Studio, as you know, here at Gold Evans is involved in a lot of initiatives, both in our paid work, but also in our advocacy. We do a lot of things around town, a lot of engagement. About 6 months ago, our group decided that we need to take some time almost every week to sort of look in the mirror and ask ourselves what we're really trying to do as part of developing a website. We really wanted to have something online that we could point to say, hey, this is what we're trying to do when we're trying to explain it to people that we talk to. Gold Evans, of course, has a firm-wide website at goldevans.com, but the firm really has a number of really unique groups that specialize in very specific areas of expertise just beyond the design services that the firm has. The Planning Studio is one of them, but we also have an education and canary studio that focuses on graphic design and marketing. So this week, I am excited and very relieved to announce that the Planning Studio has officially launched our website. So if you're curious about what we do and how we think, you can now find us at goldevansplanning.com. So that is a huge relief that it is now public and finished and out on the web. So we've been excited to get that shared.
Oh, I know what it takes to fully gestate something like that. I saw you post a link to it. And so I checked it out and it's very gorgeous. And I like that it describes what you do. I mean, what you all do there is very unique and thought leadership-esque, you know, whatever the proper way to describe that would be. You guys are thought leaders in this space and it's cool to see it described and presented in the way you have. So congratulations. I know that's a lot of work.
Thank you very much. You know, it's been fun to see sort of our practice evolve over the years that I've been here. And I actually took on the initiative of building the website, not fully knowing what I was getting myself into. So we really gave it a lot of thought and I'm excited that it is now officially complete. So that is my contribution this week.
Very cool.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Chuck. And thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Thanks. Let me show you what I'm about to do. I'm about to get out. Hit the town tonight. Oh, I'm about to get down.